You're listening to TFM.
Want to join in the conversation and share your thoughts on this episode? Join the Babel Conference, our listeners' discussion group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field, and we'll look forward to seeing you there.
Hey, everyone. I'm Rod Roddenberry, and you're listening to Trek FM.
Taking all these books?
I thought I'd take some light reading, in case I got bored.
Well, hello and welcome to Literary Treks, TFM's books and comics show. I am just one of your hosts, Casey Pettit, and with me, as he always is Jonathan Cohn. Jonathan, big day for the interview.
Yes, we have an interview with Una McCormick about her new Star Trek Strange New Worlds novel, a hardcover, the second hardcover book, titled Asylum. The first hardcover came out about a year and a half ago. That was John Jackson Miller's The High Country. And now we have the second one, Asylum. And the third one comes out very soon. Comes out very soon with James Swallow in a couple months.
Yeah, toward the night. Yeah, it's getting a lot of Strange New Worlds. But yeah, as we look forward to the new season coming out, we got to get some books to read here. Well, before we let Una out of the green room, she can hang out with Dayton for a while. I want to let everybody know how to contact us. You can find us on just the regular interwebs at trek.fm. You can follow us on X and Instagram at trek.fm. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/trek.fm. And while you're there, check out the Babel Conference, which is our listeners only group on Facebook. Just type B-A-B-E-L into the Facebook search field and it'll come right up. You can find our Goodreads group on, get this, Goodreads. Look up Literary Treks for the groups and you can check out like what books we're currently reading and what's coming up. And we can have discussions if you want. Pretty cool. Also, if you would please join us on Patreon at patreon.com/trekfm. We could really use your support to keep these podcasts coming to you. Any amount would be lovely, but if you want to be an associate producer of any of your favorite shows, you could join Greg Rosier and myself as associate producers of Literary Treks. We'd greatly appreciate your support. And, you know, if that's not your bag, just, you know, give us a rating and a review on your podcast platform of choice. That would really help us out. It, you know, gets us in that algorithm and helps people find the show, and we can keep shows and interviews with authors like this one coming at you. So thank you all for listening to all of that. And now we are, gonna just go and let's talk to Una.
Yeah,
we'll go. You can talk to Una.
Yeah. I'll be talking to her.
Yeah, I have to jump, but we will. We'll be back on the other side of the page flip. So, welcome to Una.
I am pleased to be joined by Una McCormick. Una, thank you for joining us today.
My absolute pleasure. Very glad to be here.
So, the first question I had for you was, how did this process for starting this book start? Because I know your last book was the Picard Second Self. We were really sad we couldn't get the interview for that one ready, but we're glad that this one worked out. And that was your last Star Trek book about 2 years ago. So how did the process for Asylum come around?
Well, first of all, you could always book me again to talk about Second Self. I love talking about Second Self. One of my favorites of my
absolutely.
Books. So by all means, fit me in for that one. Goodness, now I'm trying to remember how Asylum happened. So I think it was something to do with, well, Una's got to do a book about Una. So let's get that one out there straight away. So I think that was probably where this started. And It was quite a complicated process because, as I'm sure you're aware, there was a writer's strike. So, as I recall, this was originally meant to be a tie-in with season three of Strange New Worlds, but we couldn't get things to align. So the kind of we obviously had to meet a publishing schedule, which sadly did not meet the schedule of the Writers Guild of America, God bless them. So we let them get on with their business, and we had to reframe this book a little bit. So I think the idea originally was, Una, would you like to do a Strange New Worlds book? We should probably do it about Una. Let's do it to tie in with season three. Oh, this strike isn't getting resolved. Let's pull it back to sort of tie in more with season two. But then, of course, season two had gone out, so the book's kind of fallen in a bit of a quiet time. But you know, these are things that happen. But I think Una by Una was the original premise.
Did they ever get confused, or did you have to always use your last name and her last name in order to differentiate in your emails or communicate with the editors?
Oh, it was fine. I think I referred to her as Una originally in the book, because any excuse to type my own name is lovely. But
Absolutely.
I know any, you know, there's me in print. We went for surnames in the book eventually because I think it fits just more with that. That's how they refer to each other in a Starfleet context, isn't it? But I would happily have had Una on every page.
Oh yeah. Well, she is in quite a lot of the book,
He is.
and the book is split up. You have basically two time frames. You have the 2233 time frame, which is like the Academy time frame, and then you have the 2260, and every chapter alternates. How did you balance the story? Because sometimes when writers do this, it can feel like one is more engaging or exciting. And so you want to make it so that both feel equally interesting, so people don't feel like, oh man, we're going back to this one, or yes, we're finally getting to the story I'm interested in. How did you make it so that both seemed very interesting?
So I usually what I do when I write split narratives like this is that I tend to write the bits, I tend to write the them all together, yeah. So I don't write it alternating. I will kind of write the whole story so that it always has momentum. Yeah, those internally have momentum. So I did this with Second Self as well, which we're not talking about because we're going to talk about that on a separate occasion. So
Absolutely.
and I think there were I think I just had to remember that there were charms to both stories, that we love seeing the characters in the Strange New World setting. Yeah, okay. That's obviously really good fun because we love them from the show. But at the same time, there's always fun in seeing younger versions of the characters, and particularly somewhere like the Academy. So there was always something that was going to be fun to bounce back to. Either you were getting the folks that you know from screen, or you were getting kind of glimpse of them as younger and slightly less competent people. And that's always enjoyable in its own right, hopefully. So that was kind of what I did. And I'm pretty sure I would be amazed if I hadn't written them straight through as two separate narratives, but always mindful that the breaks needed to fit in certain ways. I got a bit of flack for Second Self, which has this kind of nesting structure. So I thought, I'll alternate this time. I'm not gonna do one and then the other, because it gives suspense. Yeah, there are things you want to reveal, but you want to hold off, or you want to call forward or call back. So that keeps it fun for me to write as well, and gives it more variety and tone.
Yeah, and I think that it worked because the Academy storyline seemed much lighter and fun and felt like a breath of fresh air, and then the 2260 timeline felt very action-packed and mysterious and very tense. And so you got a bit of the tenseness, and then you get a little bit of a reprieve, and then you go back to the tense stuff. And so I thought that it and I thought that the characters were so delightful in both that it worked for that. So I think that was a smart move.
Excellent. Yes, because I think we should be, you know, it should feel like an Academy story, because they're not out in the real world yet. But at the same time, I think obviously with Una, she's concealing this big secret. So the real world is always going to be intruding in some way. And then, yeah, the kind of front story, the story in the timeline that we know is a bit more of a serious mission. And there are people at stake. The stakes are a little bit higher, perhaps. So they're more kind of It's to do with the diplomatic mission, because why not? You know, that's what Star Trek's about. It's about diplomatic mission. So the stakes perhaps are a little bit higher in that front story.
So talking about the Academy storyline, you have Una, who has just really overscheduled herself, and she just keeps adding more to her schedule. She just keeps adding more and more and more.
Yeah.
And you really do a lot to keep her busy. And then she has to figure out how to balance everything properly. And how did the discussion of what her Academy days looked like? Was that something that you had any direction from the team at Paramount and CBS? Or was that more of a you had the freedom to write how her Academy days went?
So we always check in back with the guys. At the time, it was Kirsten Beyer who was sort of taking the lead on nudging, you know, kind of making sure that the books were consistent with what they were doing. And mm-hmm. I've worked quite closely with Kirsten on previous books. This one, I think what we wanted to do was make the Academy feel like that these were serious. You know, these are young people, but they're serious people. And to some extent, a large amount of what I draw on is that I live in a university town. Mm-hmm. It's a very well-known university. I live in Cambridge. I've taught mm-hmm. Cambridge yep. undergraduates. And I'm involved with a program here. I sort of have lectured on it and given seminars on it. That's about change makers. And it's very concerned with sort of going, oh, okay, you know, you're 18, you're 19, you're 20, you're getting degrees from one of the most prestigious universities in the world. What are you going to do with this in the mm-hmm. world? What's the change that you're going to make with this? And it seemed to me that the Academy would have this, that at the back of their mind, these people would be thinking, well, we're going to be going out there. We're not just going to be scientists. We're going to be first contact people, unless they're on the Cerritos, of course. We're going to be the first contact people. We're always striving for excellence. We're always pushing ourselves a little bit more. We're always, you know, adding a bit to the schedule or whatever. But at the back of their mind, there would be this sort of idea of it's not just about pushing yourself forward. It's about the contribution that you're going to make, the service that you're going to give. So that was something I really wanted to. And for Una, it's complicated because at the root of her ability to be in Starfleet is a deception. And I thought that was a very rich vein to kind of explore, that somebody who is excellent and is an excellent person in her own right, you know, has good morals and a sense of duty and service, is concealing, it's all, there's this lie at the heart of it, and the stress that must be for someone who is basically a very moral person, very, very, you know, she's quite straightforwardly upright, yeah? So to have this lie, I think is very, it's just very interesting. Dramatically, it's very interesting. So those are sort of some of the things I was thinking about, I think. These young people and, you know, their plans.
And she has an unlikely friendship develop in the book with Pike, who is back from the ship, and he's returned to do a little bit of a trial. And while he's there, he's guest lecturing. And Pike never, to me, I thought it was just an interesting perspective, him serving as a guest lecturer. You having worked at a university, did you have an idea of what kind of lecturer you were basing him off of or how his style would go?
Yeah, so I think he's got this very relaxed. So he's very relaxed, Pike, isn't he? When you see him sort of cooking for his crew, he's very relaxed. But he's clearly mm-hmm. authoritative, yeah? But it's a different yep. kind of authority from Kirk. It's really interesting. He's just got this, it's almost like, it's not like he's the host, but he's, it's a little bit like Sisko in a way, when Sisko's cooking, yeah? There's something mm-hmm. that's genial, but just gently authoritative about it. And he's got this presence, I think. So that's the kind of lecturer I thought that he would be. Also, I got a lot of gentle fun out of being just slightly older than them. Yeah.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. but sufficiently older that he's not quite, he's a bit more, hey, fellow kids, you know? and he's kind of conscious of that as well. Right. This could look really naff if I go, you know, try and make them my buddies. And it's, so that's interesting for him because he's, last time he was at the academy, he was a cadet. And now he's back, and he's not teaching full time at the academy, but he's this sort of, you know, he's an ensign, so he's still quite junior, but he's in mm-hmm. a teaching position, so he's got to maintain that distance. But he's much yep. younger than all the staff and closer to them, so I think he's finding it quite interesting as well. I think I have a joke about his hair is in a style that looks like he stopped listening to new music a few years earlier, yeah. He's just not as young as the rest of them anymore, but he's still mm-hmm. young. So I think he'd be a great lecturer. He's just got this very relaxed style. But at the same time, I think because he's very competent, he would just convey this sense of expertise. So I think he enjoys it. I don't think he'd want to be in the academy full time, absolutely not. He wants to be on board ship. And as he's there, I think because of this role of him not being a student but being in a teaching role, he starts to begin thinking about, you know, I do want to be a captain. Who are the kind of people that I would want as my crew? And this is what brings Una to his attention. I like the idea of Una coming to Pike's attention.
And they form such an interesting friendship because it is obviously not a romance. And yet, you know, her friend Mullins, I think it is always teasing them, saying that, of course it's a romance. And of course, towards the end of the book, he's teasing her that he's going to find someone for her. And so they develop just this interesting friendship. And I loved the discussion where she says, I think I'm looking for a captain. And I was like, oh, that's so sweet. Like she's like recognizing, yeah, he's a good leader and I would make a good number one. And, recognizing, hey, this is a dynamic that we can take to the workplace later on.
Yeah. You see, I think Pike, if there was any chance of a romance, Pike would be there for it. I think he is. he's absolutely attracted to her. He thinks she's, he thinks she's superb. You know, she's got a brilliant mind. She's intelligent. She's interesting. She's intriguing. I think he would love this to have been a relationship. She makes it absolutely clear that that's not on the cards. And he's like, right, okay. But I still want you in my life. I think you're fantastic. So given that that is not going to happen, what are the terms on which we can be? So he respects that boundary. He steps back and he says, okay, well, you know, it's not, they have a little exchange where she's going, I think it's a captain. He's going, no, there's another word for the relationship that we can have. It's called friendship. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. And I think she's quite lonely in many ways, obviously, because she's always keeping a bit of herself back. So it's good for her as well.
And this storyline from the past ties into the mystery in the present with the whole Chionian and Exana conflict. And the world building there of having, you know, a cultural minority and a cultural majority and them trying to escape, but also just wanting to be able to live their lives there. How did you come up with the world building there? And how did you come up with the political situation?
So, you know, I'm always sort of reading and paying attention to what's going on and to the user. I tend to draw quite widely. I don't think there are ever direct analogies. I think the closest to this one, I mean, there are many, many places where you can find similar stories on Earth. Probably the closest would be what's happening to the Uyghur Muslims in China at the moment. So that would be a situation. But the stuff about the language, I mean, you could find anywhere. I'm learning Irish at the moment for a variety of complicated reasons. And that's a language that's been oppressed and you know, consciously politically oppressed in certain ways. So I drew a little bit on that. And then there's all kinds of bits and pieces. My kid is mad about snow leopards. So I said, okay, let's have some snow leopards. in the book. And then I, you know, I was talking to my other half. Well, you know, what are the kind of things that cats would do to kind of, you know, what intelligent cats, what would they do to show that they were, quote, civilized? Yeah. Well, they'd snip their dew claws. Yeah. And these kinds of things, they'd want to not look savage, quotes again. So, you know, that became a big cultural thing. So they're kind of snow leopards and servals. The majority group are sort of meant to look a bit like serval cats who are slandered. I know nothing about servals, but we're sort of, you know, they're put in the oppressor's side. So I feel a bit bad about, I'm sure that, the serval population will want to take me to task. So you sort of, there's a whole mishmash of things that you start exploring and thinking about, and you know, it all, you just got to be logically consistent as you write about them. I liked these. I wanted to put some cats as well, because I've been reading a load of Vonda McIntyre stuff, and in her Star Trek books she always has cats, alien cats. And I think we're seeing a lot more alien cats in things like Lower Decks and that kind of thing. So I thought, yeah, the cat's time has come. If I can't have cetaceans, I'll have cats. So there's always a lot of influences. And the next thing you know, you're kind of inventing a language with autonomous verbs and no passive tense. Yeah.
I noticed the letter X was used in a lot of names, N-A, X-H-A, things like that. So I was like, oh, I can tell this character is from this species because the naming convention, you had a very, even though like it may be hard to describe, I could tell the naming convention worked for the species. Good. And so it made it so that I never felt confused on what species I'm reading about.
Yeah, and you should be able to feel that, you know, one group uses sounds and shapes that's very different. So what there's lots of X's and H's. There's kind of zh sounds with others and ch with the other. So it should, when we do the audiobooks, I always get an email from the people doing the audiobooks saying, here's a list of words that we're not sure how to pronounce. Right. Okay. And I go, oh, God. I said, you know what? I'm just going to, these are quite hard to describe without me relearning the phonetic alphabet. So I've never had to do this, but I ended up just doing an audio file for them and sending it back. Because I kind of looked at it and went, it's not consistent. It's not, every XH is not the same, but that's because every XH is sort of not in the same place, but I know how they sound.
Right.
So I just read them out. So it seemed by far the easiest thing. But hopefully, yeah, you could always tell that these people were Yuxana and these were I forgot what they are now, Kyonian. So you should always be able to tell, I hope.
Now, the book has, like a lot of your books have, a lot of really rich, deep themes, and it explores a lot of interesting questions. I particularly, the idea about how to deal with the refugee crisis, but also to deal with the terrorism crisis, because obviously the Federation is sympathetic to the plight of that minority group of Exana, but at the same time, they are not quite as sympathetic to the terrorist acts. And so they have this kind of double problem where they are trying to stop terrorism while also helping that side. And it just, you know, there's many rife applications for today. But when exploring those themes, how did you balance what the Federation's response would be?
Well, I think in this case, you always have to go back to, and I don't want to sort of, I try not to labor it too much in books because I think it's quite well trodden in Star Trek books. You have to go back to General Order One, and ultimately they are constrained by that, by the Prime Directive, as it becomes. They can't interfere. But at the same time, they can admit refugees. And if they've admitted refugees, then I think there's a moment in this, then if the government that these people have fled from says, you know, we want them rounded up and interviewed, they're going to go, no, we don't do that in the Federation. That's not how it works. So it's a fine line, particularly as I think a lot of the, you know, we say terrorism, but a lot of what the Yuxana do throughout this, but I think there's just one moment where they cross it, there is a bomb.
Right. Yeah.
Mostly it's graffiti and, playing rebel songs, awkward moments. Mostly it's a, they stay quite carefully one side of that line. They play it pretty well, I think, those I wouldn't even call them terrorists, those protesters. And then yes, there is a moment where the line is crossed. That's not we're well into spoilers now, aren't we?
Oh, so, yeah, of course, yeah.
And
our audience is used to this.
That's not planted by someone who's Yuxonan, of course. So
that was also quite getting into this. Getting into that mystery. It was interesting because you have the Exonin who's on the team, and so naturally the attention goes on him.
Yeah.
And as a reader, we are trained to say, this is too obvious. It can't possibly be him.
Yeah.
And so we start thinking, no, it's not him. And then you start hearing about him and his life and his brother, and you're like, maybe he did do it. Maybe this is a really clever, making it super obvious that you think it's not that, but then it is that. Like it made me question. I was like, it can't be this, but is it that? And then you finally reveal, no, it's the other guy who had sympathies, who actually himself is not Exon, and he's Kyonian, but because of his sympathies, he joined this group. And I just thought, that's so interesting that the Exonin is the honorable one who is trying to do things the proper Kyonian way, and the Kyonian is the one who tries to do things the Exonin way.
The Exonin way, yeah.
Right.
Yeah, I know. I mean, I'm glad I sort of set you off on the wrong track, because I had a fairly limited cast of characters.
right.
There's only three of them. So there's a couple of beta switch. I think there's one little brief moment where you think it's the head of the diplomatic mission.
Yes, I did. For a brief moment, I did. Yes.
Going, no, it can't be. No, she's a nasty old bigot. But is this a kind of, is this like a Reichstag thing where they're, planting bombs to,
exactly.
Badmouth them or whatever.
Yeah, look at what they did.
Look what they did. They're terrible people. Yeah, exactly that. So with only three suspects, I have to kind of bait and switch you a little bit. But good, I'm glad I kept you guessing until, some of the way.
Yep.
Yep.
Yeah, that was pretty nice. And with that mystery, that was when you got to use a little bit more of the Enterprise crew during the Strange New Worlds time. And obviously it is Pike and Una's book for the vast majority of it. However, we did get to get, like Noonien Singh, she gets some time to kind of get to be snarky and angry about the way that, people control, her. And, you also get to see some of the other, Enterprise crew members, that show up at times. Did you do a lot of rewatches of the first two seasons of Strange? Well, I guess it may have started before season two came out, but did you do a lot of rewatches to get the voices, or did you feel confident?
Oh, no, you have to kind of, if you're going to write a book like this, you've got to, I always rewatch in the run up. And because so much of these books hangs on how you get the characters to sound like the characters they are, and you need to be listening to their voices. So it's always been incredibly difficult. To do the Picard book, the first Picard book. We hadn't really seen anything, so to get Raffi's voice, is extremely difficult. And that's happened with Doctor Who books as well. That I've done the first for maybe like the Jodie Whittaker Doctor, and you've just not really seen the companions on screen. You see it, but they usually let you see a little bit of footage. I mean, by this point, obviously we've got lots of episodes, again, I sort of tend to focus in on I always like to have a kind of quite tight point of view cast. So Una obviously was going to be in both, Pike was going to be in both, but then you need a kind of extra couple of eyes on the situation. And Noonien Singh's perfect. She's a gift of a voice. So, why wouldn't you want her?
Absolutely, yeah. Yeah, and she's distinct too, yeah, which made it her contrast well with Una and Pike.
Yeah.
The book also has going to a lighter element of the book. Hmm. The book also has something that I loved, which was a ton of Gilbert and Sullivan references, which I'm a huge Gilbert and Sullivan fan.
Brilliant.
The Modern Major General is just such a great song. So much of what they did. And I got super excited when there's all this discussion about the Mikado, because my dad was in a production of the Mikado.
Oh, brilliant.
So when you make all these references to the parts and how difficult the roles were, I'm like, yep, I know that. Were you familiar with Gilbert and Sullivan, and that's why you put it in, or did you have to become familiar to use those references?
No. I know Gilbert and Sullivan quite well, particularly know the Mikado quite well.
Mm-hmm.
My kid, again, we had while I was writing the book. So obviously we have that little short trek where Una sings Modern Major General to mm-hmm. Spock in the lift. So I knew there was going to have to be some Gilbert and Sullivan because she will have done that at the Academy. We went to see we took my kid to see their first Gilbert and Sullivan last summer, and it was a mm-hmm. production of the Mikado. It was an all-male production. There's a director in Britain called Sasha Regan, and she does these all-male productions of Gilbert and Sullivan. And they're massively, so there's cast, but they're usually really quite young actors. There's maybe out of a cast of 12, there'll be three or four doing the first stage. Yeah. So she's got this very youthful, very energetic cast as kind of minimal set. Yeah. A lot of energy, extremely, extremely funny. It feels very fresh because I think one problem with Gilbert and Sullivan is it can feel archaic. Quite fusty, yeah. So she's made them very fresh. We took my kid. My kid absolutely loved it because my kid loves theatre mm-hmm. at the best of times. And then we just spent that entire summer dipping deeper and deeper into Gilbert and Sullivan. And in fact, just about 3 weeks ago, we went and saw Sasha Regan's all-male Pirates of Penzance.
Delightful.
My God, it was incredible. It was so much fun. It was really good. I Google her, Sasha Regan, and you can see these productions. So it was hilarious. The guy playing the Pirate King, he's straight out of drama school, and he was amazing. When you think you've got, like, you know, Kevin Kline's behind you, and you've just gone, no, I'm going to do it completely different. So the Mikado was looming quite large while I was writing the book. And then I thought, well, you know, part of the fun of the Mikado is one of the things you've got to wrestle with the Mikado is that you can't really do it as Imperial Japan anymore because it's a bit racist. Okay. So a lot of contemporary productions have kind of had to wrestle with that and you change names or whatever. The way she did it was it's a group of lads who've gone camping. Yeah. They're out on like a school camping trip, and they're just putting it on as a kind of entertainment for themselves. And one guy who's the master who's with them is kind of coming in, and he's the Lord High Executioner. So I thought, well, they would just have loads of fun at the Academy, weren't they, thinking, well, what are we going to do? What's our take? It's not going to be the schoolboys camping. It's not going to be that Jonathan Miller 1920s one. What are we going to do? And they end up being bored Mars colonists, which I was really pleased with.
I'd love
to see that production of the Mikado. So a short answer is yes, I do know a bit about it. I'm not an expert by any means, but I know a fair bit about Gilbert and Sullivan. So
I thought that it was clever, and I don't know if this was conscious or subconscious, but in the Mikado you have, I believe, I'm trying to remember the character's name. I think it was Pooba, but you have the character who gets all the roles put on him. He's like I've got the exact roles, but he has like all these government jobs that he is himself. And so when they say, oh yeah, did you have anyone from government? He was like, well, this person was there, this person was there, this person was there. And it's just one guy because he has all those roles. It's just one guy,
Lord High, but everything else, yeah.
It reminded me of Una in the book.
Yeah,
because she has all those roles that she's trying to be in a role in the Mikado. She's trying to be one of the top in the class. She's trying to be this helpful person to
the to the Chionians, the Ixonans. She's trying to develop a friendship with Pike and Mullins, and so she herself has all of these roles. And much like in the Mikado, she realizes, one person shouldn't have that many
that
roles.
Many roles. I should have. I didn't think of that. I should have made more of that.
Yeah, I thought that worked out really well for the book.
Lovely, so. Good. Well, yeah. I'm glad you're a Gilbert and Sullivan fan. That should be an extra bit of enjoyment.
Exactly. And something else that I thought was interesting in the book was you have this discussion about what to do with your talents. And you have, the characters that were from Una's past. You have the characters like Angsa and Hox and Naxana and Foxo and, you know, the ones that she was trying to help out. I almost used the word minister to, and I was like, that's not exactly the right word. But she tried to help them out. And then you have, I believe it was Hax, that becomes a lawyer. And he, you know, originally he wanted to be in Starfleet, but eventually he changes and decides, you know what, I can use these skills that I could have used in Starfleet and instead use them to try to help out the other Ixonans and use my power for good. And did you have a thought of how you would use all the characters' talents, or did you really just want to focus on Hax when you were writing the book?
Yeah, so it's sort of a theme in the book as well. I always find it really interesting. We first get this story with Jake Sisko, don't we? That not everybody goes into Starfleet. Yeah.
Right.
Right. So what do they do all day? And some of them maybe go into diplomacy. Clearly, we see a lot of diplomats, or they go, you know, they become politicians and they go in the Federation Council. But, there must be other things that people do. Okay. And right. we will always need lawyers, right? Okay. There will always be lawyers. Yeah. So, I'm always interested in having people that decide that Starfleet isn't for them. And that happens with Una's peer, Teresa, in the book, is that she kind of goes, mm-hmm. Do you know what? Actually, I'm not interested in this. What I'm interested in is this other thing. Mm-hmm. And she takes what I think is a really gutsy decision and leaves.
Yeah.
So to have done that well and got that far through the academy and to go, do you know what? Not right for me. I'm not going to be happy. Whereas Una, obviously, is kind of, you know, she's born with the Delta on her top. So and Hax, I think he makes a similar sort of decision. I think Hax's decision is also guided by the fact that he feels he has a responsibility because he's been able to leave and mm-hmm. become a Federation citizen. He feels he has a responsibility to the people who are left behind, some of whom will be, you know, he'll be related to, they'll be back on their home world. That the privilege he's gained from becoming a Federation citizen is something that he wants to leverage. And I think he leverages it. He feels that going into Starfleet, he would have to be Starfleet first and not Yuxana first. Mm-hmm. Whereas if he remains, if he's not in Starfleet, he can be Yuxana within the Federation. So that was the sort of thought processes. His sister goes back home and becomes, she's amazing. She kind of goes back. She's right in the thick of it, but they can't touch her because she's a Federation citizen. So
right,
she,
yes. Yeah,
so she uses, she uses the same kind of privilege, but in a different way. And I guess one of the things that the book is asking people to think about is when is direct action more appropriate than when do legal processes, how far can they take you because the law is stacked against you? When does something more direct become necessary? And what's the line, the thing we were talking about before, what's the line between a kind of passive resistance and active resistance and then something that tips over into a sort of combat, violent action. So the book is sort of offering you a spectrum, hopefully, on that kind of theme.
And one of the, for me, kind of heartbreaking moments of the book was with the uncle. Uncle, I think it was Foxo.
Foxo,
When he goes to Una's apartment. Mm. And because, you know, he had been cast out by his sister-in-law, which you will totally understand why she's acting this way. Mm-hmm. She's like, I finally have a chance to live this good life here, and you could ruin it for me. And so I totally understand her perspective. But at the same time, I was like, you made me sympathize with him, even though maybe I might disagree with him on stuff. You made me sympathize with the guy, and it was just so heartbreaking to see him just go so far and basically attack Una in her apartment. When you were writing that, how did you write that sequence while telling the grave severity of it, while also making us care for this guy who still is attacking someone we love?
Yeah. So I think I went through several iterations of that. I thought about making him, you know, somebody who's taken direct action, who's planted bombs, or, you know, has done whatever back at home. And then I thought, actually, no, that's not as interesting. And what I hope is clear is that he's a stand-up comedian. Yeah. He's all he's done is tell some jokes. Yeah. And that's got him on the run. And the irony of what happens between him and his sister-in-law is that she was the firebrand once upon a time. Yeah. She would be the one who would be out demonstrating or throwing stones or, you know, doing whatever. I don't think she ever went as far as planting bombs.
No.
that once she's got the kids, she kind of gives that up. So that should feel ironic. I only feel completely sympathetic for Falk, so, because I think it's mostly an accident that he harms Una. I think it's because he's not trimmed his Duplo, yeah? For one thing. So I think it's bad luck. He's obviously distressed and terrified, and thinks that she's being recalcitrant, which is why they get into that scuffle. But certainly harming her is a mistake. And of course, being harmed has these consequences for Una that he would know nothing about. So everybody should feel sympathetic towards everyone in that scene, I think. And the people you should not feel sympathetic towards are the authorities who are putting all of these people into an impossible situation, is my feeling. Yeah.
And I also, back to Una's mm-hmm. roommate and friend, I also felt so bad for her because she ends up having to take the fall, and she ends up having to, that's her excuse to get out. Mm-hmm. And also she kind of covers some stuff for Una as well. And I was just like, and her, because again, I don't know if her friend has shown up in a show or something, but this was the first time I recognized the character. Mm-hmm. But I'd gotten to like her character. I thought she was such a likable character, so it was so sad to mm. see that happen to her.
Well, yeah, but she's up for it because, you know, this is the kind of work that she's doing. It gives her clarity. I think probably what goes through her mind is she thinks, oh God, we can't lose Una from Starfleet. Yeah,
right,
that's a travesty. And it's a travesty mm-hmm. based on a prejudice, which isn't right. And then she thinks, well, somebody's got to take the fall for this. Well, whoever takes the fall for this will have to leave Starfleet. Would it matter to me if I left Starfleet?
Right.
Actually, no, it wouldn't. Yeah. So I think it's almost a blessing in disguise for her in some ways. In my backstory, yes. Historically, she's from a kind of an oppressed group on Earth. So think she's meant to be sort of descended from Irish travellers. I always try and do this in my books. There's usually a character who's a descendant from a group that's been historically oppressed on Earth. So she's one of those. There's usually somebody like that in one of my books. It's not always apparent, but I always put them in because I always think these groups that are oppressed, I want to sort of say that they should be in the future. Yeah. That mm-hmm. they're gonna make it. And in this case, I think because Teresa's aware of her kind of obviously is aware of her kind of family background, her cultural background. It's something that inflects her choices. So everyone in that book where everyone's got a sort of personal connection to the main theme. So that's Teresa. It's not a sacrifice for her, I think. I think possibly it's a sacrifice that, some friends think she was careless.
Right, and also for Una, because she's losing a friend from Starfleet.
Yes, and they kind of lose touch, don't they? But then when they do get back in touch in the future bit, it's
That was touching.
It's like, I imagine they stay in touch after that. So it's and it's I like to feel that somebody knew Una's secret, because it would have been, I find it heartbreakingly lonely otherwise. But just to know that there's somebody who knew and it didn't matter, and to the extent that they were willing to put themselves out for her to that, I think it probably stopped Una from going crackers.
Right. On a more just a fun note, I wanted to make sure to get this question in here. Did you at any point try to get Garrick into the book at all?
Absolutely not. Not even I could have managed that. Maybe I should have put one of his lines in, but no. And I didn't even mention Cardassians.
Are we sure you wrote this book?
I'd absolutely swear that I won't. I wrote this book. It's got reflections on the Irish language. It's got Gilbert and Sullivan. It's got people
Right.
saying, "Una, you're so marvelous on every." Una, you're amazing. Una, you're such a grade A student. Oh, this is hard work. I'm turning up every day. But no, it didn't even cross my mind to put Garrick in it, because I think you've read Second Self, haven't you?
I
Yeah,
have, yes.
So I think I've said my goodbyes to Garrick. So and there's no way you could get him in A Strange New World. I mean, not even a kind of cameo, and no way to do the Cardassians on it. It wasn't a Cardassian
I was just wondering throughout the whole book if at some point Una's just gonna have to go to a tailor for something, and you're not even gonna explain what's going on. You just say, "Oh yeah, she's going to the tailor."
I did put a tailor into one of my Firefly books,
Oh,
who's
nice.
clearly meant to be Garrick, or hopefully
Right.
people know it's Garrick. So Jane gets this sort of, Firefly, he gets this sort of dark blue velvet dinner suit, dinner jacket done, and he talks about the I can't, what does he call him? That it's that. I don't know if it's that crazy little tailor on somewhere or other, on some space station or other. So yeah, but Garrick's in one of the Firefly books, but not in this one.
We're gonna have to get you we know that we got David or Dayton Ward got a Next Generation and DS9 crossover book. We'll have to get you some sort of crossover book set during the show. That way you can get another crack at Garrick one day.
Oh, I loved that. I really loved his book. That was such a clever. I was kicking myself I hadn't thought of that.
Exactly.
Gosh,
You're
I
like,
thought of that one.
darn.
I've never done one during the occupation. The book I'd love to do. I don't think I'll ever get a chance to do this. I'd just love to do a book about Kira, Garrick, and Damar on Cardassia Prime, just being really rubbish. I'd love to tell the whole story of that rebellion, but
Well,
I don't think I ever will. Yeah.
Margaret and Ed, if you're listening,
Yeah.
give her that book.
Commission this book.
Yes, commission that one. Of course, we would read it.
But no Garrick in this one.
We were in our discussion off camera, we were discussing if we should somehow like in our reviews, "Oh yeah, and we love that Garrick reference," just to see if it would throw people
It's
off,
just,
but we're not gonna do that.
could you believe it when Garrick said, "Oh yeah, you're just completely." I'm up for that. We could recall a whole kind of fake discussion of the scene with
Oh
Garrick
yeah.
in.
So before we leave, can you tell everyone if you have any projects you're working on or anything you can talk about that's upcoming for you, or if you have any book signings or anything, and then also if people can follow any newsletter or anywhere online for you, where they can follow that.
Right, so I'm mostly off Twitter these days, but people can find me on Blue Sky, which is sort of the replacement for that, and it's the same handle. It's at Una McCormack. If you find me there, then there's a link. I've got a Linktree page, and there's a newsletter, which I'm a bit bad about at the moment. So I've got to get a bit livelier. The reason I've not done much on my newsletter is that I've been writing books this year quite for most of the time. So I wrote this one. I've written a Doctor Who book, which came out earlier this year with the 15th Doctor. I've got a few other projects, but I don't think they've been announced yet. But they will be, so people should come and find me. And then the other thing that I would love people to take a look at is I'm involved with a science fiction imprint called Gold SF, which publishes intersectional feminist science fiction. So take a look at some of what we're doing there, because we've got some really cool stuff there, none of which involves Garrick.
Okay. I didn't know you were on Blue Sky, so that's good.
Yeah, I'm there.
Well, thank you so much for joining us today. And we'll look forward to having you again, not just for your next Star Trek book, which there should be a next one, but hopefully we'll get another Second Self discussion.
Yeah, Second Self special. I love talking about Second Self. I really loved that. I really enjoyed doing that book, so I'd be happy to do that. And thank you for having me. It's been a hard road for this book, because it hit up against the writer's strike, and are we going? What are we doing? Is it stop start and everything? So it's really nice to know it's out there, and really nice as always to think that people are enjoying it. So thank you.
Well, Jonathan, it's always awesome to have the authors join us and take some time to come talk to us. And it's a real privilege, I guess you could say. I mean, it really is to be able to talk to all of the authors that we love reading. And, especially when they got a book coming out, I'm sure, they're exhausted from all the writing and whatever they're doing, but yeah.
And it's nice that exciting. Una was able to make it work, because I know that, trying to negotiate between time zones can be difficult for us. And it's already hard enough for you and I, and we both live in the States, yeah. But to try to add in someone from the UK is a lot more work. So we really appreciate Una for making it work.
Yeah. And we'll have a similar issue, I guess, when we talk to James Swallow. Hopefully we get a chance to talk to James his book comes out in April. But he's over there in the same neck of the woods as Una is. But but before we get there, we've got we're actually diving pretty far back into the pantheon of Star Trek books, to back into the numbered novels for mm-hmm. next time.
Yeah, we're talking about Star Trek number 49, The Pandora Principle by Carolyn Close. And you mentioned that you wanted to read this one after we read the most recent Greg Cox novel that included Savick. And this is apparently a Savick book. So I, other than knowing that it's a Savick book, I don't know anything about this one, so I'm going in pretty blind.
Yeah, same. I think Greg might have mentioned it either on the show or just when we were chatting with him before or after. That there aren't a lot of Savick books out there, and so I thought, well, heck, let's read another one while we're at it. Well, when you're not reading about Savick, Jonathan, where can people find you?
You can find me on YouTube for my YouTube channel, Jonathan Cohn, and you can find my where I do all things books, all whatever book you read, I probably talk about it. And then I also have my Twix account, my Twitter X account, at Jonathan Cohn. And then I also am on Goodreads on Jonathan Cohn.
And you can find me on Goodreads and Letterboxd and Instagram and X at Knitting Trekkie. And then I'm also lurking around on Facebook in the Babel Conference. So please join us there. Well, thank you everyone for listening. And until next time, live long
and read on.
You call that light reading?
To each his own, number one.